Everybody, and I'm Hunt Tooley, and this is the Ludwig von Mises Institute Mises Academy course on totalitarians. So welcome to another session, and we have a lot of grim things to talk about today, but it's a very interesting topic, and so I think we'll manage to get through it. It's a, you know, all the that information about the course. Here's how we stand in the 8 weeks plan of the current Fuhrer. That is, we're looking today at the crimes of the total state. And so we spend most of our time on, about two-thirds of our time on the Soviet Union and about a third on Nazi Germany. And the next week, we'll talk about some more comparisons. We'll begin to bring in some more totalitarians, and we're building here, I think, a pretty good basis for comparing, which we'll do some of in the last session too. Oh, and let me please remind you that next week on Easter Sunday, we will not have a class, so we will skip, and then we'll come back for two more weeks after that. Okay. No class next Sunday, so you can peacefully go hunt Easter eggs or whatever it is that you would normally do instead of coming to this class. Okay, well, let's plunge right in and start talking about the Russian side of things. We really haven't sort of traipsed through the past of Joseph Stalin. And so I'd like to start with that today because that brings us right where we want to be. This was a man named Joseph or Yosef Djugashvili, and sometimes you see that spelled with a D in front of the J, pretty much the same spelling. He was born, of course, in the Caucasian country of Georgia, and born in 1878. To a working class family. His father was a cobbler, I believe, and also a kind of ne'er-do-well, also given to alcohol in the same way that Hitler's father was. And the father, in any case, left the family, and the young Djugashvili's mother, I'll just call him Stalin, okay? The young Stalin's mother made sure that he got into a seminary when he was 16. I mean, she tried really hard to kind of keep up his connection with the religion, and those Georgians were Greek Orthodox. He was in a seminary and expelled in 1899, as far as we know, for a kind of decision that he made to become a part of the revolutionary underworld. We've already really established that there was a huge social revolutionary underworld from that range from the populist to the Marxist to the peasant socialist to the anarchists in all directions, and the state pressure, the state repression of those movements had really made those movements very cohesive and so forth. I mean, they were all sent to these camps in Siberia, but that worked as a kind of school for revolutionism. And so there got to be this fairly large class of revolutionaries, and it became known as a kind of, I don't know, avocation. So the young Stalin joined this movement, joined in with the Marxist Party just after its founding in 1898. And then went along with the Bolsheviks after the split of the party in 1903. This was his preference anyway. He was much more a hands-on kind of doer rather than a thinker, although we'll see that he wrote some things in his life. But basically, he was part of a shadowy group that did what we might call fundraising, except that it came through killing people and stealing from them and robbing banks. There's the famous Tiflis bank robbery in 1907 that made him very famous. A bunch of people killed during that. So he was busy doing this kind of heavy hand work for the party through most of these years. Not your intellectual who sits in Geneva or sits in Basel or sits in Brussels and thinks about things, but rather a hard guy out organizing the occasional strike and then robbing the occasional bank, etc. In fact, Stalin, this is interesting, Stalin only left Russia or the lands of the Russian Empire for only about 6 weeks during his, that was the longest he was out of the country during his whole life. He just didn't leave much. So unlike all the other old Bolsheviks who were this kind of intellectual class of people who lived in garrets in New York or London, he was very different type. He was, however, because he was a Georgian, he was a good man to tag on Lenin's part in 1912, 1913, when he needed somebody in the party to write a book about the nationalities question. Lenin was just perfecting his theory about capitalism being imperialism being a higher stage of capitalism. He was in the process of, you know, putting that book together, which appeared a couple of years later. But he really, in terms of his theory, understanding that most of the people in the Tsarist Empire were not, in fact, ethnic Russians, this led Lenin to want somebody to appeal to them to kind of expand on this question of different nationalities, suppressed nationalities as a world proletariat. I mean, that's what he was thinking. And so he got enlisted Stalin, whom he hadn't known very well, and Stalin wrote this book, and Lenin kind of brought him into the inner circles of the Bolsheviks. In April 1917, just after the first Russian Revolution of 1917, Stalin was elected to the Bolshevik Central Committee. And about this time, too, he also was using the name Stalin on a regular basis. Before this, he had been called a number of things. He went by a whole series of aliases, most notably the alias Koba, K-O-B-A, which was a leader of an insurrection for freedom in a popular novel that was well known in Russia at that time. And so clearly from early on, he chose names that kind of indicated what he wanted to do. I mean, it's hard to know what was in Stalin's, well, obviously impossible to know what was in Stalin's mind, but we do have these little hints, such as the nom de guerre that he took for himself. So he was the hero freeing everybody. And then by the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, he was pretty much full-time Stalin, the man of steel. So he's elected to the Central Committee and then becomes the Nationalities Affairs Commissar on the Bolshevik Central Committee and participates in a lot of the Civil War terror, especially down in Georgia, but also elsewhere. Then, as we saw last time, he became the party secretary in 1922, and this allowed Stalin to kind of build an organization in the wake of the Bolshevik victories in the Civil War as people flooded into the party, you might say, opportunistically. It allowed him to sign all these people up to be the face of the party for them, to be the organizer of the party and make these links that would later lead to a Stalinist movement and even a Stalinist kind of esprit de corps. We'll talk about that later. After Lenin died in 1924, as we said last time, there's a struggle for power. Really among Trotsky and Kamenev and Zinoviev, and some others entering the picture periodically, but with these old Bolsheviks and with Trotsky, the old Menshevik turned Bolshevik, And eventually Stalin, with his, I mean, he's no intellectual match for Trotsky on his very best day, but he knows all these, let's say, processes of trickery and skullduggery and wet work and all these kinds of things. And so he's able to win out. He's a very a careful person. And one thing that we see in this period of time is Stalin doesn't always have one opinion. I mean, there are times when early on when he was arguing against terror that Lenin was carrying out. But it's also true that Stalin is consistently a detailed kind of a guy. Now, we'll talk in a little while about Hitler's personal regime, and he was anything but a detailed man. Hitler was all about the big picture. He was all about thinking in these big terms and letting other people plan these out. While here, I think, is a really interesting comparison between the two people, that Stalin is this detail-oriented guy who's at his desk all day long and into the night every day, while Hitler was watching movies into the night every day and sleeping until noon. Well, he picks up another nickname at this point, and that is Vosht, the Russian word Vosht, and he begins to be called the leader along in this period of time, 1927-28. Whether this was a conscious copying of the Duce in Italy, I do not know, but it seems like it must have been because all of these people knew about all of the others, so it couldn't very well be, but I do not know that, so don't quote me on that one. By the time he's leader and gets control of things, carries out a series of early show trials and early repressions in 1927 and 28, well, he's able to announce that henceforth there will be no deviation from the party line. And the party line would be defined by the leader, and the leader was, of course, Stalin. And so after this, Stalin defined all of the party politics in terms of left deviationism and right deviationism. And so, for example, when he heard in 1934 that Hitler had killed off all the leadership of the stormtroopers, who were basically the kind of left-wing, rabble-rousing, proletariat Nazis, Stalin said, got the news with his coffee in the morning at the office and said, ha-ha, that Hitler really knows how to deal with his left deviations. So that's where we get the whole idea of the party line and hewing to the party line. In 1928, he decreed his first five-year plan for economic independence and excellence to show the communist system at its best. He immediately begins through show trials, executions, an expansion of the secret police and so forth, the extension of the Gulag system, the concentration camp system. But still in all, I think it's well to remember that for all of this, for all these expansions and that and all that, and that's why I put that picture there, I think it's important to remember all this is Lenin. And there were times when Stalin was learning the terror from Lenin, when Stalin would say, well, why do we have to kill them all? They've all repented and now they're on our side. And Lenin would say, well, you'll see. So this is pretty much teamwork, and Stalin is in so many ways a real, spiritual successor to Lenin. I want to talk for a moment about Stalin's economic theory, if you can call it that. Stalin knew very little about economic theory, about the ways economy worked. He knew a lot about the way banks worked, just in terms of storing money and moving it and so forth, because he had made a study of that in his early bank robbing days. But he really had very little in the way of an idea of how how an economy runs. And what he knew was that Lenin had adopted war communism, a kind of intensive copy of that Hindenburg program that Ludendorff had cooked up. And so he took from that and from some other ideas of his a very specific kind of state, totalitarian state control. Stalin was, I'm moving this around a little bit, I hope that doesn't disorient you. Okay, Stalin was in the first years of his rule, once he was able to exile this leader and that leader and this old Bolshevik and that old Bolshevik and put this one out to the countryside, and Trotsky goes off and is on the lam and hides out and all those things. Stalin is thinking in terms of what he calls socialism in one state. Now, this used to be taught as the main thing that Stalin was thinking about, and that he had altered his whole conception to create a kind of national socialism in the way that Mussolini had envisioned. I think almost all scholars now who study the original documents, who think about how Stalin's activities worked, and now that we know what's in the archives to some extent in the Soviet archives, I think almost all scholars now believe that Stalin was just thinking of this as a kind of station on the way to world revolution. He really did want world revolution the same way that Lenin did. But they waited for it. They thought it was happening. It happened in Hungary. It looked like it was happening in Bavaria. It looked like it was happening in Saxony. And then, you know, things just kind of dried up, and the reactionaries took over, and the state police took charge, and the armies took charge. And so it didn't happen. And so Stalin is looking at this from the standpoint of the survival of the revolution and socialism in one country. And he works from that aspect. So from this standpoint, he's saying, okay, for a future war, if we're going to war, if we were attacked by the West, if there were a second series of interventions more coordinated than the 1919-1920 interventions on the part of the West, then what should we be ready for? And he knew very well that the Red Army had been very meagerly supplied, that their tactics had depended on hit and run and old-style cavalry and things like this. So he wanted to expand heavy industry. So the theme throughout Stalinist economic thinking is always heavy industry, the kind of things that you produce for war. Artillery pieces, coal, steel, all the components, that type of thing. So heavy industry is on there. Bigger is better, that's for sure. For Stalin, the more concentrated an industry, the better. And this writes the script, in a way, this goes all the way back to the Hindenburg program. But Stalin is the real expander of this here, that you get bigger and bigger and bigger things. So if you're gonna have hydroelectric dams, you build the biggest ones possible, huge, enormous hydroelectric dams. If you're gonna organize production of anything, so rolling stock, well, that's all gonna be built in one city, and it'll be a factory with 100,000 people in it. And they'll build rolling stock for railroads and streetcars for the whole country. That type of thing. So he wants to concentrate, not for any economic reasons, but for control reasons. And then, of course, there are commissars over each operation. These commissars can more easily watch, in his mind, can more easily keep tabs on a single organization with 100,000 than 10 organizations with 10,000. There is, of course, no economic calculation possible. And of course, this is all right in the wheelhouse of Mises back in the days of these heady days when he was basically a huge participant in the debate over economic calculation. Of course, Hayek in London and all these famous kinds of things. And so it was, there was a laboratory for this, and that was the Soviet Union, where there was no market. There was no economy except in the black market itself. And so everything went by a quota system, and of course all prices were just set in a kind of never-never land of Stalin's lead bureaucrats' offices. So so the quota system was what made things run theoretically. In practice, and I'll skip down to the reporting bullet point there, in practice, the reporting for this was all lies. Because, frankly, you think about it, in a Stalinist system, you don't make your quota. What are you going to put down on that little report about the quota? So, for example, you get you're at a factory that's making tractor engines, and you order 30,000 ball bearings, and the shipment comes in, and there's only 20,000 or 10,000 ball bearings in the shipment, but on the lading bill it says 30,000. What do you do? You can't make it. You can't make your 300 engines you're going to make and send out because you don't have enough ball bearings. Well, you make 100 or however many you can, send them out, but just fill out that bill of lading 300. So there's a kind of dishonesty that goes throughout the whole Stalinist system. It's based on not just based on the never never land of bureaucrats in their offices, but based on the real fear of people who have to make their quota. I mean, they just have to. So they lie about it. And this means that all the statistics from the Soviet Union throughout that period of time are all falsified. I mean, they're just it's all a fake. And so I often think about the whole rafts of economists, historians, and so forth who made their living in universities in the 60s and 70s talking about economic policy in the Soviet Union, when in fact all their materials were corrupt. All their data was intrinsically no good. So that's what I mean by reporting. They were going to report that they made the 300 engines no matter what. The regime tried to respond by, in a very interesting Stalinist way. There's this kind of positive, souped up, juiced up, vacuous propaganda aspect that you may know if you saw that great movie. What is it? About 10 years old, about Stalingrad, Enemy at the Gate, and you know it's all structured around this sniper. Am I getting the right? Yes, I am getting the right movie. It's all structured around this famous sniper who was pretty good. That's right. But in fact, he was made this great hero, the face of this sort of heroic face of the Soviet Union. Well, this had already been long since done in all kinds of areas, and the guy picked out to be the face of this new kind of economy was after the 5-year plan should have been over, but of course after the 5-year plan didn't achieve what it needed, then there was a second 5-year plan and a third, etc. But in August, on August 31, 1935, Alexei Stakhanov reported that he had mined 102 tons of coal in 5 hours and 45 minutes. That was 14 times his quota. Well, he's a better man than I am, because I had never mined that much coal in that length of time in my life. The next week, 227 tons in a single shift. Needless to say, the ground is prepared in November 1935 already. The first all-Soviet Union Stakhanovite conference met in Moscow, and the Stakhanovite movement was born. That is to say, They made him a hero. They promoted him. They sent word to the United States that reporters vacuously said, "Oh well, the Soviet Union reports that that in the workers' paradise, people work so hard they mine 14 times as much coal as they even need to. What a great experiment this is." And so they put him on Time magazine. And that tells us something about the whole attitude of the West toward communism, which we'll discuss a little bit later, but which we've already been reading about in the readings that I've assigned. So these are aspects of the economy. And then, of course, there's the black market, which always has attended any of these totalitarian regimes because it had to, because people have to live. Maybe that it's illegal to sell apples, but people have to have them. They have to have some kind of nutrition. And so the black market is for its ugly name, black market, it's a bright spot in all this, and began with the beginning of the Soviet Union and ended after the fall of the Soviet Union. That's a pretty important aspect of this economy. It's what kept people living. There's this part of the new economic program, and this even remained after the war against the peasants, about which we'll speak in a few minutes. But eventually, they came to the conclusion: everybody's collectivized, but every peasant can have a little bitty garden in the back of their house, and these gardens, of course, produced a huge percentage of the food in the country because people were producing for themselves and producing to sell, and so forth. Another aspect of the regime in power, let me just go back a minute and we'll just stay on the economic page for one more minute. This is a country that was a couple of generations behind in industrialization, had been from the beginning. I mean, in 1855, there were only about 150 miles of railroad in all of Russia. So it was considerably behind the United States, Britain, France, Belgium, any place that you want to talk about. But on the other hand, there always had been this export of raw materials. And there always had been this export of grain as well. I mean, Ukraine was the breadbasket of Europe. Belarus produced a good bit of grain. There's a lot of grain in the Volga district and in southern southeastern Russia. So it was a country that was rich in grain, rich in raw materials, and yet by the time we get to the 30s. The whole edifice is knocked down. So that there is no longer, not only an abundance of wheat, but there are shortages of wheat. And as you know, wheat is crucial here because that's the main carbohydrate component of that Russian diet, and that's the thing that's being periodically confiscated by the secret state police. So this is an important thing to keep in mind. Okay, so the purges. The Great Purge is in the 1930s, but lesser purges had begun pretty much the moment that communism was born in the mind of Lenin and his pals in 1917. As a great Leninist said, one Mao Zedong, communism is not love. Communism is a hammer which we use to crush the enemy. That's certainly what Stalin thought. And what happens here is that in these early purges in the 20s, he's really going against rivals. But he's developing and giving full rein to his extraordinary paranoia. But in this atmosphere, in the atmosphere he had come up in, paranoia was what kept somebody alive. So it certainly did Stalin. But he carries out the kind of character assassination has to resort to trials to get rid of his enemies, manufactures cases, eventually brings in Western reporters to watch these trials where some of his enemies even sit at the trial and confess. We'll talk about that in a minute. That certainly happened a lot in the show trials in Moscow in 1936 and 37. But early on, he's purging selected enemies of the state. Solzhenitsyn tells this amazing story that he learned when he was in the concentration camp, from somebody who had seen it personally. But a peasant leader in one of the areas of the countryside had gone to one of the local Soviet meetings, and Stalin had come to speak, and he spoke, and somebody in the crowd at the end of the speech said, "Long live Stalin," and so everybody began to clap, and they clapped, and they clapped, and they knew that the secret police were watching the whole group, and finally, really after 10 or 12 minutes of clapping, this one sort of peasant leader just stopped clapping and sat down, and then everybody did. And he was later arrested, had everything confiscated, had the usual torture, got the usual ticket to the Gulag system. And as he left the NKVD offices, they said, "Just remember, never be the first to stop clapping." So the great purges began, these very directed purges of enemies, of suspected enemies, potential enemies, begins in 1934, okay? So, and we're talking then about it. Again, there are purges going on all the time, but what we call the great purges begin in 1934 and last until about 38 or so. The high point of this is the Moscow show trials, in which all the old Bolsheviks were tried. They were charged with almost always with treason. That is to say, they had connections supposedly with the British or the French or some other foreign power attempting to tear down Bolshevism and so forth and so on. And most of them got up in court and confessed. And a lot of Western reporters came back and again said, "Oh, this is just amazing that it's a system that's so pure. Not only do they go beyond their quota when they're in the coal mine, but also when they're guilty, they just confess all their crimes to the court." Solzhenitsyn has a whole section on this. He says, "This is the stupidest thing anybody ever said. They were all tortured, and they knew that all of their loved ones were in the neighboring building waiting to have their own torture continue if the person didn't testify in the show trial. It's a very easy thing to understand, but those journalists at the time couldn't understand it." So Radek and Bukharin, I misspelled Bukharin there, sorry, and a whole range of old Bolsheviks were sent to their deaths. And you know what? Most of them, I think, we know this for many of them, but it seems as if most of them pretty much still believed in the cause. They still believed in the cause. These purges were, Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago describes these arrests in this way. He said just envision a pebble thrown into a totally smooth pond, and so the circles emanate from it, and they get wider and wider, and occasionally another pebble is thrown, and those then interlock. And as the circle gets wider, that's what the purges were. There'd be one person who was targeted for arrest for some real or imagined event. And that person's spouse was then brought into it, children brought into it, acquaintances brought into it. And finally, you get down to the level of anybody they had dealt with, like It had their sewing machine from their house worked on at a in somebody's place. So they bought a pair of shoes from this person or that person. So those people were arrested too, and the vast numbers of these people started forcing an expansion of the gulag to hold many more hundred thousands than it had before. But they were all faithful and said, well, you know, this is just the Soviet cause. It is true that a lot of people are getting arrested, and it is true that I am a loyal Bolshevik to the end, a loyal communist to the end, but I still believe. And this is what Bukharin wrote to his wife, and it's what Yevgenia Ginsburg, that's G-I-N-Z-B-U-R-G, Yevgenia Ginsburg, wrote an absolutely stunning memoir of her time in the Gulag, and she was a devoted Stalinist, and her husband was shot. He was too. They were a new man, the new Soviet man, they said, the new Soviet human being, and yet they, you know, for one reason or the other, they got swept up in one of these purges. He was shot. She went to Siberia, the descriptions are just beyond belief. I mean, it's very, very much analogous to what you read if you read the Gulag Archipelago. Very much analogous to any Nazi work camp. I mean, it's the same huge death rate, same diseases, and all that, and just as much hunger, even more hunger. And so in the end, she finishes her story, and it ends up with this little piano phrase to Stalin. And the cause. And I know that even though these things were bad for me, the individual does not matter, and that Comrade Stalin must have known something that meant that it was a good thing for me to be picked up. So this is a part of that culture. So they come in waves. The old Bolsheviks are a part of it. Early on, there's engineers. The engineers especially were targeted, because the engineers had the kind of esprit de corps in old Russia. And continued on for some time within the engineering profession in Russia, so that Stalin thought, no, these guys are too sure of themselves and too sure of their value to society. So they went. Many of them accused of being wreckers of the Soviet Union. Intellectuals were hauled off in great numbers. Eventually, he turned against the army. That one's obvious. And there were many other groups that were just purged. Now, I'm going on to the killing, the mass killing here in a minute. But these are just the purges. So you have to, you know, when setting out to conceptualize this lecture, I had a real task before me, because where do you start here with the crimes of these kinds of states? Let me just mention the role of the secret police here. It's not a hugely complicated history, but it is a little bit confusing in that they change names frequently and there's a little bit of reorganization. So I thought I'd throw in just a comment on this. If we take this from Dzerzhinsky to Beria. And Beria, of course, is the Stalin's last head of the secret state police. He outlives Stalin by just a few months, and then himself is executed. And Stalin died in 1953. So we take it now from 1917 to 1953 with this little chart, because we know that Dzerzhinsky organized things beginning in December 1917, and then died, remember, after giving a fiery speech in 1926. And he was succeeded by a person, and I misspelled that name too. It should have an H between the Z and the I, Menzhinsky. And Menzhinsky is a person nobody remembers with much fondness. He was not one of the great furiosos. He was more of a cipher, and underlings did most of the work, good or bad. as you'd like to call it, under Menchinsky up to 34. We really focus in on the leadership again of the secret police in 1934 as the purges start under Yagoda. Heinrich Yagoda, who led the first 2 years of the purges, but then in 1936 was downgraded to object of the purge himself, and his former assistant Yezhov became the head of the NKVD, and then he executed his former boss in 1937 after a lot of you might say gratuitous torture. I mean, the boss was the man who had sort of brought Yezhov along, and he did some really extraordinary things. I mean, he oversaw his torture, and then just before the execution, he had his old boss stripped naked and beaten by a bunch of NKVD heavies, and then they executed him. So, you know, that's just. I'd say even for these horrific, violent guys, that's a little bit gratuitous. Anyway, Yezhov, the malevolent dwarf, as they called him, did take over, and he sort of finished out the purges, and he in turn was arrested by his assistant, Beria, and Beria did exactly the same thing. In fact, sort of, you know, apparently had taken notes on Yezhov's treatment of Yagoda, and so Yezhov died in 1940. Through all this, the secret police changed names a number of times, from the Cheka, the Extraordinary Commission, to the GPU, and Akpu in 1923, then from Akpu to the NKVD in 1934. That's at the beginning of the purges. And then in 41, there's a separation out of the NKVD and the NKGB, and it was a kind of CIA-FBI situation, an MI5, MI6 situation. And eventually the NKVD becomes the MVD, alongside the new MGB, and then these recombine in 53, and then they take the name KGB. Pretty much, they're the same organization along the way. And of course, in this, if we ran this whole thing out to its current status, we'd eventually get to some people we know very well from modern Russian history, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. So that's a kind of a crash course in the Soviet secret police. It's the most effective secret police ever. There are all kinds of variants that we're going to talk about later on in East Germany after the Second World War, and the Romanian service after the Second World War in the period of Ceausescu, and so forth and so on. And everybody makes a little improvement here or uses a little better technology there. But pound for pound, this huge, powerful, relentless, and vicious tool of the state in Russia pretty much takes the prize. This is a fun look at Soviet photography techniques. This is our Yezhov, the guy who tortured his boss, then was tortured in turn. And here's a picture of him walking along, a sort of group photo, and there's Molotov in the background beside Stalin, and that's Voroshilov on the far left. And then Stalin's left-hand man there is Yezhov, and so then you see the doctored version of that. And this was long before Photoshop, so you gotta stand back with some admiration. They could get that thing They could brush him right out of there. Well, the Soviets were famous for this, and the communists famous for this. People fell out of favor. They just disappeared from their group photos. And sometimes they were added, too. I'll try to remember to see if I can find a Yugoslav photo where the photographers were not nearly of this quality, and where you get some very odd group photos of people standing at funny angles and things, but all for the same purpose. So these are Soviet photography techniques. Interestingly, in a land where photography had huge advances early on, I mean, in Russia, they were doing some things with color photography before the turn of the, before 1900, that were just simply amazing and, you know, still wonderful to look at today. But in any case, they said these techniques were especially used by the secret police. Well, Robert Conquest wrote this wonderful short biography of Stalin called Stalin, Breaker of Nations. And his emphasis in that book, and it's a lot like the emphasis in the second volume of that Chamberlain, the famous Chamberlain history of the Bolshevik Revolution. That is to say, the emphasis is on the regions and this tendency of the Russian Empire to fall apart during the revolution. So, I mean, there's civil war and chaos at the center, and it just makes sense that on the edges of the thing, countries break apart. Well, the Finns did. I mean, under the leadership of Mannerheim, the Finns became independent in 1917. Eventually, the Lithuanians and the Latvians and the Estonians will become independent. So there's there's a lot going on here, and of course, a bunch of Poles are able to join the German, the Poles from the German regions and the Austrian regions and create a new Poland. So that's true. So there's a lot of nationalities taking advantage of the revolution to just leave those territories. But within the Soviet Union, there were plenty more nationalities. It was, if you've ever seen this huge book that John Armstrong wrote in the 1960s or 70s about the nationalities in the Soviet Union, it's just hard to count them all. That's the thing. It's hard to count all the languages because you have some obvious ones, but then a whole lot of medium-sized ethnic groups, and then a lot of tiny ones, especially up in Siberia and in Central Asia. So so it's there's a lot there, and oddly, Stalin didn't hate them all or fear them all, but he did fear certain ones, and he took extraordinary vengeance on those and extraordinary measures to get them out of the place where they could do him ill. Now, I have to say this. The Russians had done this before. The Russians tended to do this in a number of cases. In World War I, for example, the ethnic Germans behind the Russian lines, as the German army and Austrian armies moved forward, in World War I, the Russians ethnically cleansed regions of both Germans and Jews. And that was the Pale of Settlement, so there were a lot of Jews there, but also a lot of German settlements. And numerous villages of ethnic Germans and the villages of Jews were just rounded up and driven into the wasteland in the middle of winter, more frequently put on a train and shipped to someplace far to the east. But Stalin was not working on this mostly, for the most part, during wartime. Some of it was. But in his mind, there was permanent warfare anyway, and a lot of these people scared him. So on the far eastern border, the East Koreans scared him a lot, and so he deported a couple hundred thousand of those people. Poles, he absolutely despised and repeatedly, from 1938 onward, carried out ethnic cleansing actions against them that ran into the millions. Romanians, both in 1941, then again in a whole different way, in 1944-45, were ethnically cleansed. And to tell the truth, the Soviet occupation, as we know now from recent research, the Soviet occupation brought so many Romanians into forced labor gangs who were hauled away, never to be seen of again. There's a kind of ethnic cleansing there. Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, all ethnically cleansed before Operation Barbarossa in 1941, and then of course after the Eastern War had run its course nearly by 1944-45. Volga Germans were systematically ethnically cleansed. That is to say, driven from their homes, all their stuff taken, and for the most part, these people were dumped in the Central Asia or some similar place within the Soviet empire. Ingrian Finns in Karelia, Crimean Tatars. That's a whole heartbreaking story unto itself. The Crimean Tatars. Each of these is, of course. Also Crimean Greeks, Kalmucks, Balkars, Karchays, Meskhetian Turks, Karapapaks, Chechens, and Ingushes. So, you know, if you add all these together, and it's difficult because the records are not always clear, if you add all this together, you get something like 3.3 million people between 41 and 49. And most of these people were hauled off and plunked down without supplies, without tools, without anything, basically, in Siberia or Central Asia. So the estimates of the death tolls are extremely difficult to run out, and it's only been in recent times that scholars had any way into that question. I know that when we had a big ethnic cleansing conference in Pittsburgh, in 2000, we came out with the book of those papers a few years later, in 2003. These were some of the first articles on, for example, the Crimean Tatars that had been seen in the West. So it's all the way to 2000 before you can really tell a lot of these stories. And some of them are not so clear because there just were not many records of those, and so many of the people involved were killed or put in a remote place where they just died. But it seems like 43% of these nearly 3.5 million may have died from harsh treatment. That's just an estimate. I think we'll never know the extent of that. So Stalin is a breaker of nations, yes. We'll talk about some of these groups more as we go along. That was the ethnic cleansing. Here's the war against the peasants, which is not an ethnically motivated war, although it comes into it. So let me explain what I mean by the war against the peasants. And the photograph there is a great propaganda photograph. It shows a group of peasants with those big rakes and everything. You can see Lenin up there and Stalin and various posters, and somebody's going to explain to them how great it will be to collectivize. So this is a scene from the collectivization of agriculture. The Marxist-Leninist view of peasants, and this does start with Marx, and it goes right through Lenin, but it is important to realize that Marx hated peasants as well. If you think about it, all of Marx is predicated on a proletariat taking the lead, and the proletariat, the proletarians are the good guys, and everybody else is the bad guys. And to tell the truth, he doesn't say anything about peasants, which is strange in a country that was is his Germany that he grew up in was 40 or 50% peasant, but farmer. I mean, that just means farmer. But he viewed these farmers, for the most part, as part of the bourgeoisie, I think. And in fact, I think that Marx, and then later Lenin, too, took a special umbrage at the fact that these farmers should be part of the masses rising up, but they're really just greedy for land and greedy for more, and they're just the worst kind of petty bourgeois business people, always looking for a little better price for their grain and all of that stuff. So there is a very jaundiced view toward the peasants. And another thing that they knew was that, frankly, once you got past popular outbreaks and people's woes in the countryside and bad weather and all that, that peasants did tend to vote. Remember, as Bismarck once upon a time said, peasants tend to be conservatives. Farmers tend to be conservatives. I mean, they have the ones who own the land, especially, and own some property, tend to be extremely conservative. So Marx and Lenin both despise the peasants. One of the things that happens then is that Lenin comes to make this anti-peasant revolution in a country where about 70% of the people are peasants, where a huge number of people are farmers. So what that means is that that this part of the economic program is going to be an extremely difficult part, the collectivization of the peasants. I see a second V in there. I really need to take some time off and proofread these things before I throw them up here. But my apologies. But the collectivization of the peasants, that just simply meant for the peasants who owned anything, it meant the loss of everything. It meant that all peasants in a region would be organized into a commune, and there were two different kinds, a state commune and a Soviet commune, in practice about the same. But they were collectivized, they were just brought together, they were supposed to pool their resources and then produce for the common good on the quota system in the same way. And so, in a way, it corresponds to Stalin's predilection for big collective things rather than individual kinds of things. Now, this war against the peasants was started under Lenin, and we've talked a lot about the confiscations of wheat from the countryside during the Civil War and very early on in the Soviet regime. And of course, one of the key roles of the original Chekhov was this very thing. I mean, this was a really crucially important function, not just a kind of sideline, to expropriate the peasants and all that. And we talked about how the outrage of even the sailors, the Red Sailors of Kronstadt, when they went home on leave over the winter 1920-21 to find their countryside, their homes ravaged by all this policy. Well, the NEP backed off just a little bit. And this is a funny thing. You remember the very first that the Bolshevik the Bolshevik slogan was land, peace, and bread. But I mean, what does it mean? I mean, we know that Lenin just kind of laughed at middle class morality, including honesty. But anyway, that was a very important slogan that got the Bolsheviks a long way toward their ability to carry out the coup d'état, and so they immediately began expropriating the peasants. But they back off a little in the NEP, and what happens is if there gets to be a class of peasants, it's traditional. If you read back into Russian agricultural history just a little bit, you'll find that there always was a kind of natural differentiation among peasants. If you've ever read those wonderful short stories of Turgenev, the Russian, it's a Russian classic called Sketches from a Hunter's Album, you'll know that Turgenev in the 1840s and 50s was looking at a countryside where there were big differentiations. There were well-to-do peasants who had a big oven, strong sons, a lot of land. They were buying more land. Other peasants would would come to the porch hat in hand and ask if they could borrow a few kopecks for this or that or the other. I mean, it's just a going concern. It's sort of a natural elite that grew up in these different places. The funny thing about Russian peasant society is that it really was a kind of anarchism, in that it was, or rather a kind of rule of families and rule of elders in these villages. So anyway, that had always existed. Well, the revolution had wiped out much of that, but after the NEP, after 1921-22, then there got to be differentiations again. And even when everybody had been slapped down and had everything taken away, and many of the relatives killed, much of the labor killed in the wars and all that. But the same families tended to reassert themselves as prosperous peasants. Now, in his great classic book, Harvest of Sorrow, Robert Conquest, which is about this war against the peasants and the hunger, hunger genocide that followed, if you want to call it a genocide, that's kind of what people are moving to now. But he points out that the prosperous peasant, whom Stalin labeled a kulak, these prosperous peasants had maybe an income 1.3, possibly 1.4 times the rest of the peasants. You see what I'm saying? They only earned just slightly more, and yet they were labeled kulaks, and that simply meant kind of like a bandit. They were labeled bandits, and the connotation was that, especially that they were loaning money and ensnaring their fellow peasants on the countryside. And so that was the connotation there, the kulaks. And so it's against these people that Stalin began to move in the very beginning, 1927-28, to demand that these kulaks be brought into collective farms. There were a lot of protests, and the protests were triply serious in the peripheral regions in the west and south of the Soviet Empire. And so that would mean in Ukraine, above all, a place where, from a nationality standpoint, those people spoke a completely different language from the Russians. Same way with Belarus. I misspelled Belarus. That should be A-R-U-S. Belarus also spoke a very different Slavic language from Russian proper, and in some other areas. So when there were protesters and these kulaks were rounded up and sent to the gulag, these were, for the most part, people from the periphery. Some in Russia, but more from the periphery. And as Conquest is at great pains to make clear in all this, this is a war against a lot of different peasants. But from the standpoint of Ukrainians, it looks like a war against the Ukrainians. It looks like an ethnic war, and it may well have been in Stalin's mind that both were the case. Well, what Stalin did was, when there was a lot of protest on the countryside, there were a lot of local revolts, there was some violence. There were also people who just downed their tools and just said, "We're not gonna work." So what Stalin did was just to kind of go with that latter idea, and he said, "Well, if you won't work, then let's just take everything you have." And so the well-known techniques of confiscation ensued. This occurred 1932 to 1933 for the most part. Again, it was in predominantly in Ukraine. There's Belarus spelled correctly, and the Volga region, Moldova, Kazakhstan, some other places. But the real heavy point of it, with the central part of it, is really in Ukraine. It was a systematic starvation of people. It was something extremely satisfying to Stalin. It was it was a horrific death toll. It was the death toll between 7 million and 11 million people. Stalin told Churchill at one of the conferences, and Churchill recorded this in one of his books. Stalin told him that he thought he'd killed 16 million, and Churchill said, "Excuse me, I thought you just said 16 million." And Stalin said, "Yeah, 16 million." So that's what Stalin thought that he had killed. In retrospect, it appears it may be less, but we may not know the whole story on this either. If you've ever read a text about this or heard someone speak about it, I had the opportunity back in the 70s to talk to a woman who had survived this famine, this artificial famine, and it's about the worst thing that you can think about. You know, she said that the thing was they were in their little town that they didn't have any food at all. People were eating grass and trying to make a soup of grass, but then it just tears up your digestion and makes you sick. And she said, so they didn't have any food, but they did manage to get morphine supplies from someplace, and so they would inject the babies so that they wouldn't cry as they were, so they'd at least be sleepy as they were starving to death. It was a horrific period, and the starvation is just beyond anything you can imagine. If you look this up on the online, you can see picture after picture after picture. I'll also point out this, that that this term Holodomor is the Ukrainian word for this whole event, this hunger famine, and as often happens, people always focus on themselves. The Ukrainians tend to tell this as a uniquely Ukrainian story, but certainly many, many others were involved in it. Although, again, it was the main part of this was certainly in Ukraine. I don't know. We need more crimes from Stalin. I mean, I haven't even mentioned the events in Poland. I'll talk about all that in just a second. But there's plenty there already. There's some millions of people there already, Stalin will turn out to be one of the great killers, if not the great killer in all of history. You could argue whether Mao gives him a run for his money. We'll talk about that later. Let me say something. Now we begin to connect our two big totalitarians together in more ways than we already have. And one important way comes through the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which was really the immediate prelude to World War II. You remember the case. Hitler has always talked the anti-communist line, and he's always said that he's unalterably opposed to Soviet communism. And yet, when the Allies don't offer Stalin enough swag in the summer of 1939, as they're all kind of gearing up for war, then Stalin turns to the Germans, and Hitler's happy enough to make a deal. And we call this the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact just because the foreign ministers, and you see Molotov on the right, and Ribbentrop there just to Stalin's right. On the occasion of this pact, they're all happy-go-lucky after this. And this map here is that's basically the map that the two foreign ministers signed. So that's their initialing of the map that comes from the German archives. So, what did it do? Well, it divided up Eastern Europe. Stalin and the Russians had always thought that that Poland had been too far to the east, and that Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, Finland back down to Romania. All these places had always had, had been too far, if you look on this map, too far in this direction. So they all needed to go, Russia needed to go to the west and encompass more of this whole region, okay? So, in fact, I'll show those little purple things. I'm not sure what good those do, but it's fun to see my name there. what this led to, well, I didn't mean to do that. I gotta get out, there we go. Well, I'll just leave it there. One thing that this whole division of Europe did was to help further the sort of the tendency of Poland to be a killing field. I sent out an extra reading to you in which I kind of gave some thoughts to this this whole business. That article was written before Timothy Snyder's fabulous new book, Bloodlands. His book is about 700 or 800 pages, so I recommend my article first. But I did rely on some of his writings in there. He's an authority on these regions. But here's the thing. If you think about this, I've just listed a few here. I ran out of space, really. But if we think about Poland as a killing field, so Stalin cleanses the Belarus-Polish border in 1938. By that, I mean this. I mean that he went into all of his the western edge of the Soviet Union, and then drove out, and then in the process killed many people. He drove out all the populations of Poles who happened to live there. Now, their families had lived there for generations, centuries, but he just drove them out. He didn't trust the Poles. That's another group that he especially didn't trust. So there was already an ethnic cleansing before World War II ever, came into it. The Nazi-Soviet pact divided Poland, and so Stalin gets the eastern part of it. And what he's going to do immediately is to take the eastern sections, and maybe I can go back here and actually use my pointer. If you can see this map, what he's going to do is to take the eastern sections of Poland here and stick them back onto get them back into the Soviet Union, and then in these regions, then he's going to drive out the Poles. So he's driven out Poles here in this area before the war, and now he takes over immediately after the Polish armies are beaten, and takes over here and drives those out, okay? So the Poles get it here first, then here, and they're driven out, and they basically are just kind of floating populations, and until we get to another stage of this thing. What happens is that the Germans, and I'll go back to this map, the Germans are on this side of the line, and they set up a huge, some of this territory, as with Russia, some of the territory they incorporated into the German Reich and call it Germany, some places that have been called Poland. And then the rest of it that they don't even lay a claim to here above Slovakia, this area they call the General Gouvernement, the General Government, okay? Meanwhile, the Soviets, and remember how this, you probably remember how this went down. The Germans attack on September 1st, Stalin didn't attack. And once it seemed that the Polish army was pretty much beaten, then Stalin attacked on September 17th. And so in this area where they moved up to the pre-planned Molotov-Ribbentrop line, in this area they began to not only do their ethnic cleansing, but also take care of Poles in other ways. So that, for example, they took the officers who had been POWs, and thinking that these formed a really potent a potential for resistance in later years. He just had him killed in Katyn Forest and some other couple of other places. 20,000, but maybe an equivalent number dumped in the North Sea and some various others. And so there's this violence in Poland. You know, there's a great memoir by a woman who ended up teaching at the University of Connecticut. It's called Dry Tears, and her family was Jewish. They lived in Poland. They ended up in the German part of Poland right after the war, and the father, a small factory owner, he was a very active, independent-minded person. And as soon as he could, he took a trip to the Soviet zone, ostensibly on business, but really to check out to see if they could, if it wouldn't be good for them just to go to the Soviet zone. And he came back and he said, well, you know, to tell you the truth, we're in trouble as Jews over there, but we'll be in trouble as middle-class people, as business people over there, in the Russian zone. So to him, the chances were better to stay on the German side. And in the event, it was a narrow escape, but they ended up being saved, or saving themselves. So what happens is that this Nazi-Soviet pact lasts for 2 years. This, of course, is really important. Most people don't think, in this class, I'm sure all of you would, but I'm sure you know that most folks that you talk to wouldn't have any idea that the Soviets were actually Hitler's allies for the first part of the war. But in any case, they had a falling out when Hitler decided to attack. The attack was called Operation Barbarossa. It's a huge, enormous attack, 3,000 miles across into Russia. And that was June 22nd, 1941. Here's a map, and you know, I don't know why I could only find one with Polish labeling on it. I really worked on this a little bit, but it's not hard to decipher. Here is here is the general government right here, and then these areas were just simply incorporated into the German Reich. The blue outline, this is a good map, and this is one reason I wanted to use it anyway, because it has a good picture of pre-war Poland, and then it shows you who took what. A trouble that's going to occur during the war comes in this along this whole zone, and it comes when there gets to be basically an ethnic war that starts when Ukrainian nationalists began to take advantage of the war to do ethnic cleansing on their own and cleanse Poles. All right, and then later we're going to get Poles being ethnically, Ukrainians being ethnically cleansed by some Poles, in a kind of continual cycle of violence. So there's more violence down there. We've already talked about the ethnic cleansing and the killing up here. The Katyn Forest stuff happens around here. And then we have to ask what's going to happen in the general government. And the answer is this is the whole machinery of the final solution, of the Holocaust. So we get, we'll see in a moment, another map with, or maybe I forgot to put it in. But if we want to place all of the main killing centers of the Holocaust, every single one, they're all within this in this zone. The only one that falls outside, it just happens to be where they drew a borderline, and Auschwitz is just here. So just outside the border. But Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, all of those were within this general government area. This occupied Polish area, and so that's pretty important, of course. So there's that killing too, an enormous amount of it, maybe 4 million, maybe 5 million Jews killed, and not just from Poland, but from all surrounding places, and eventually all over Europe shipped out And if they didn't die in some other way, made it to there. Talk about that more in a moment. But you see, well, and then what's going to happen at the end of the war is that Stalin's armies will come in. Wish I could reverse that little arrow, can I? Well, I guess I can't. But Stalin's armies will move into here, and as they get into these regions here, where there are now German, not now, but where there have always been German populations in these areas, Upper Silesia there, and Pomerania and so forth, when they get there, then the Russians and the local Poles will ethnically cleanse, in the greatest ethnic cleansing operation of history, they will ethnically cleanse about 15 million Germans here, and that goes then for south of there, and drive those German population from the Sudetenland also in Czechoslovakia and all the way down, actually, to Yugoslavia. And they will drive those people out, and about 1.5 million of those people will die in the process or die later on. So when you, what happens to these ethnically cleansed Poles from the east? Well, they're sent to take the houses of these Germans who have just been driven out. I mean, it's a wreck of a picture. And I have to say, I mean, whatever else we call this, whether it's the fortunes of war or the fortunes of whatever, this is basically the triumph of the modern state. I mean, you know, if war is the health of the state, this makes the state all important. This is what this very process means, that the state is shaping and corrupting everybody in the process. So it's the grimmest, most awful stories. Okay, well, quickly back to Hitler, and then we'll get to the question point. I'm going pretty slow today. Sorry about that, but I'll speed up now. So just to review, Hitler comes into power January 33. There's a fire that's set by a communist, a young guy in the Reichstag, and the Reichstag catches on fire. He's probably got helpers, we don't know. But as a result of that, the Constitution is put out of effect, the Weimar Constitution, and there is an enabling act that does that in February 1933. And from 33 to 36, Hitler carries out something like, it's kind of an analog to Mussolini's idea of corporatism. Hitler calls it coordination, or Gleichschaltung, which is it's kind of a high-tech term. It's a term that came actually from the infancy of electric circuit boards. But he's talking about sort of switching or coordinating a circuit board, and in this sense, coordinating the groups in the same way that Mussolini had talked about that in corporatism. And he does this one group at a time. So he co-opts the parties and eventually gets them to just do away with themselves. And he co-opts, tries to co-opt the army, and he co-opts the others in all these various ways. So Gleichschaltung is going on with all kinds of groups in society from 1933 onward. This is all backed up by good old police state methods. The concentration camp invented outside Germany and Russia, but very rapidly adopted by them, comes to the fore almost immediately. By March 1933, Dachau is set up and in business. There's a story behind that. I'm now writing a little piece on it, and that's an interesting story indeed. But in any case, Dachau's there, and pretty soon it becomes only the first in a huge network of concentration camps. Not killing camps yet, okay? These were just, at first, places where you went and served a term and then got out. Some did, anyway. There was some work involved. There was some roughness and brutality involved. But, in fact, it got worse along the way. I'd say the early ones were not anything close to Guantanamo-type conditions, nothing close to that, and it didn't get that bad for a long time. only the NSDAP was allowed to be a party by the summer of 34. As I said, the parties were co-opted, and Hitler did his, as you know, his left, his attack on left deviationists in June 1934, when he allowed the SS and its Gestapo, which was a part of the SS, to wipe out the leadership of the SA, which was the stormtrooper, brown-shirted, rough guys in the streets, and Hitler's old friend Ernst Röhm. They were all killed. But Hitler also significantly took advantage of this whole episode to kill off a number of conservative politicians with whom he'd had dealings before, who he thought would be dangerous. So he's he's working on a little bit of paranoia too. And Hitler certainly had his own kind of paranoia. I don't think he could match Stalin, but there's certainly that. So the Night of the Long Knives. I mean, so they're both killing their political enemies. Stalin's killing is much more extensive. Hitler was elected president when Hindenburg died, and he said he didn't want to be called president or prime minister since he's now both, but he'll just take the title of Führer. So now all three of them, Mussolini, Stalin, and Hitler, are called the leader in their own language. 1935 is the year of the Nuremberg Laws, when they finally come out with extensive laws, basically dismembering all the civil rights of all Jews. But you know, I said this one time in a lecture to a class, and my PhD mentor was before I got my PhD, and he heard me say this in class. That's why I said it purposefully just now, because I always remember not to. He said, you know, you said all the civil rights were taken from the Jews. He said, but that's really not correct. He said, under the Nazis, the civil rights were taken from everybody. Nobody had any rights. That's what totalitarian governments did, to take all the rights of everybody. And so it just so happens they turned on the Jews. Well, after Schmidt said this, sometime after that, or about long about that time, I thought, oh, yeah, that's in omnipotent government. And so that's pretty much the point. It's not just the Jews who are outlawed, and indeed there are other groups who get outlawed or targeted too. Plenty of other groups and plenty of other individuals, but the Jews certainly become a special target. But everybody's lost their civil rights. 1936 was the year of the four-year plan, in which Hitler said that there would be a four-year plan on the way to war. We'll have to talk a little bit about Nazi economics in the next session, but there, I will say this, that the four-year plan was if you sort of took Stalinism and then took the New Deal, it would be something in between those. It was certainly a central planning exercise, but he would get dollar a year men from the industries, and then as those dollar a year men worked for the government, then their companies would get the defense contracts and the highway contracts and things like that. And so it was this kind of totally interventionist sort of economy, but not the top down sort of Stalinesque kind of economy. In most senses, I should say, in most senses. That came later. There certainly was a kind of top-down, totalitarian economy later, but in the that was after the war started, and really only after 1942. So from 1936 to 1939, there are these plans of brewing in the SS discussions and in other places for the planning for living space in the East. As everybody knows, then Hitler went against the Allies' injunctions and united with Austria in 1938. The Austrians, I think, had originally wanted that, but I don't believe they wanted it in 1938. Munich crisis came in 1938, and Czechoslovakia was dismembered, and these are all stages on the way to war. I just wanted to throw in this these pictures from the Nuremberg Laws because I want to talk for a few moments now about the Final Solution. I think everybody knows more about that than practically speaking, than anybody knows about the crimes in the Soviets. So I'm not going to spend extensive time on the Holocaust. I'm just kind of assuming it's a given. Here's the announcement of the Nazi Party newspaper, the Völkische Beobachter, about the Nuremberg Laws, which you see the headline there. And there's Hitler in celebration. The laws for the protection of German blood and German honor is what that says. And part of the newspaper explanations show how you're supposed to calculate if people are Jews or not. So it's all about what will happen to Jewish private property. There's already been a law excluding them from any government job, and so forth and so on. So Jews within Germany they're not killed. They're not even put into camps yet in any extent. These are just laws that make it difficult to live there, and also, by the way, difficult to sell their property and leave. I mean, there's more than one consideration there, and a lot of Jews thought that they could that they'd be able to ride this out, that Hitler wouldn't last for long, and they had pretty good reason to think that. But it was, I mean, just not a good prediction. Well, during the wartime, I meant to take that off. In the wartime, what happens is we get all the old wartime controls from World War I, plus many, many more. In fact, the whole expansive nature of the war, especially in the East, the expansiveness of the concentration camp systems produces a very confusing and an extremely interventionist kind of economy during wartime, as you might expect. It goes far beyond what had happened in World War I. And so all kinds of things happen in wartime in Germany, and we kind of date those from then. You know, as somebody has said, if Hitler had died at any of these different given points in his career, we would think a little bit differently about him. It's in the wartime. Okay, so they start the Final Solution, and we read back into Mein Kampf and say, well, he did say these things, but if he had died and not done it, we might very well be saying, well, this talk about cleansing the Jews from Germany and getting rid of every last Jew and all these multitude of things he said in speeches and in Mein Kampf, we'd say, well, this is hyperbole and it's just a kind of ranting and raving. Whereas in the end, it came to be. One of the stages of this was the T4 program, which is the ultimate in social Darwinism. That's the program that was to euthanize people who had congenital diseases, people who were mentally handicapped, physically handicapped, people who were, as the Nazis said, basically useless eaters. And this T4 program is the first. It started in September 1939, there was much, after it got out, there was a lot of protest, and people were really angry. But it actually ran in secret until 1945. And it's people like Dr. Karl Brandt, who organized the T4 program, one of Hitler's personal friends and an SS doctor and all that. It's Brandt who organizes it, and then within the SS is able to convey some of these killing methods onto the people who are actually doing the Final Solution. So it's in this framework then that Germany attacks Poland, finds all these Jews there. Hitler has been talking about what to do with the Jews. Now he has many times as many. And same thing happens to some extent in Yugoslavia, where they find many Jewish settlements, and they're killing those off in reprisal or for the Chetniks who attack. And so the final solution begins in this way, and the book that we read a part of, Ordinary Men, is by Christopher Browning, and he's one of his previous books is an excellent study of the exact timing of these decisions to carry out the Holocaust. And it pretty much comes down to the summer months, the July and August of 1941, where these things began to be applied. And then there's a course of history. At first, it's this program of the Operation Reinhardt camps, where much of the killing is done, and people being shot out in forests and so forth. And then eventually, that's all kind of amalgamated around Auschwitz. By the end of wartime, it's really the case if you read a lot of memoir literature about people who survived, that it's really the case that death got to be so common from the war fronts, from bomb attacks, from fears of what the Russians and or Americans would do, from people who've been on the front seeing people shot in reprisal or Jews killed someplace. With all of this, there got to be a real casualness as when death was an issue. Germany also had the highest suicide rates before the war and traditionally had for some reason. And so by the end of the war, there were so many people contemplating suicide. There were so many people just found walking along a road in some little occupied place in Luxembourg or someplace, and they were just in the wrong place at the wrong time, stood up against the wall, shot. There's just an awful lot of killing. The Goerings decide to kill their children and then themselves before the Russians get there. There's just, we could go over case after case after case where suicide becomes a part of the picture. So there's a kind of death paradigm, I think, that we can think about in this way, and it's very comparable to the massive deaths that Soviet citizens became acquainted with throughout the period of Stalin. I may talk about this. In fact, why don't I save this one for later? I'll just put this slide into next week's packet. It'll go just as well there. But I do want to point out that whereas we have this a clear cut history of the Cheka and the NKVD and the KGB, that there's a different sort of story for the SS SS organization. The SS was, in fact, a huge umbrella organization for basically, in the end, all the police authorities in Germany and in the occupied zones too. So there were Ordnungspolizei. These were people who were supposed to keep order in occupied zones. There were the local police. There were national police units. There's something like the FBI that is then later folded into the bigger organization of the Gestapo. But the Gestapo, the secret state police itself, was a part of the SS. There were the security police. There was the office that did the most of the planning for the Holocaust, which was called the RSHA, Hauptamt für Sicherheitsangelegenheiten, whatever it is. But there's that office that then has sub offices. So this is a very complex thing. Just in the command of the Operation Reinhardt camps, the ones in Poland, apart before Auschwitz was gotten going, in the chain of command, you got Hitler up there, who's kind of separated himself off, And then Himmler, he goes to an SS leader, Globochnik, then to these leaders for ghetto ghetto liquidation in the Polish cities, and then he routes these people to these different camps. And there's a whole huge organization that has the cooperation of the chancellery, has the cooperation of different directorates, and also, as this little chart doesn't show, has the cooperation of the transportation ministry because of the railroads involved, and has the cooperation of a big state building enterprise called the organization TOT, and many others. So this is a complex sort of bureaucratic exercise. You know, one thing I do want to say, and we're getting to the very end here, is as I think about all this, I think about Gitta Sereny, who is one of my heroes, and has written two of my favorite books of all time. Gitta Sereny was born in Vienna in 1921. Her mother, Margit, eventually married Ludwig von Mises, and so this was the stepdaughter of Mises, and I always like to think about that. If you've ever read Margit von Mises' memoir, if you haven't read Margit von Mises' short memoir, you really need to. It's a lovely little book, and you find out something about Mises, the man, that you won't find out in other places, and I recommend that highly. And Margit comes into it just kind of peripherally. She grew up in Vienna in the 20s and 30s, grew up with Ludwig von Mises as a fixture at the house, because they dated a long time before they married. But anyway, she grew up with interest in psychology and history. Got out of Germany when Mises did, and came to the United States and was in Britain some. And after the war, she returned to work with these Aryanized Polish children, the ones who had been just rounded up in Poland, taken from their families, and who were thought to be have enough Aryan features to pass as Aryan. And she worked with returning those. Actually, most of those didn't get returned, but I think maybe 1,000 out of 30,000 did. But in any case, she worked with that kind of thing. Oddly, and I think this is just a funny coincidence, she was married to Don Honeyman, who was a well-known photographer with Vogue and with the newspapers, and had some famous photographs. His most famous is that image of Che Guevara on the red background. That's his. So I think it's a very funny connection of people here. You know, if you talk about degrees of how many degrees you are away from somebody. Che was just a couple of degrees away from Ludwig von Mises in that sense. She wrote two books about Nazi Germany that are among my favorite books ever. One is called Into That Darkness. She actually interviewed Franz Stangl, the commander of who had been the commander of Treblinka, the death camp. And that's a book that's hard to read, but it's hard to put down. It's one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. So I recommend that to you highly, and you'll find out an awful lot about the total state in that, and how the total state co-opts people, and does away with their individual moral conscience, I guess you could say, makes it all right for people to do horrific things in the name of the state. The second one has some similar themes. Albert Speer, his battle with truth. After Gitta Sereny wrote Into That Darkness, Speer got out of prison 4 years later and contacted her. He had read the book and thought she did a very nice job, and so he asked her if she would work on a book with him and do some interviews. So she interviewed him. You see a picture there of Albert Speer on the left at his home in Württemberg. and get a Serenity on the right. I love this picture. It's one of my favorite photographs ever. I don't know why, but it's Cher sort of relaxed and talking on, and Serenity, who must be one of the great listeners in all of history. But in any case, that's a huge book that encompasses Cher's work, his relations with prominent individuals in the Third Reich. It is a very, very fine book. So I recommend that to you very highly. And so in the end, I mean, I just to highlight Gitta Sereny here as somebody who basically confronted these totalitarian things and did a lot about that. She had a life of working with and writing about children in an age of mass trauma and then all this brutality in general. So I just I thought I wanted to throw that point in there. And you know what? I think that I'll save my couple of final points since I've gone on and on here. I'll save them for later, and we can start with the questions now if there's anybody left. Yes, we still have 9 attendees. That's excellent. So let's just let the festivities begin, and anybody who would like to ask a question about all this mass information, you are welcome to do so. And I will get down to my chat. Ah, already stuff going on. Let me make this bigger. Need to undo that. Okay. Thank you, Floyd, if you're still here. I don't know when that was written, but thank you, because I forgot to turn this on so I would see the line there. Okay. Zaitsev, yes, that's the sniper who really was a real person. Oh, good book suggestion by Peter Magula there. Thank you, sir. Let's see. And Peter, I am not sure, when you ask how was it that so many Americans left the USA to the USSR, I am not sure what period you mean. Could you clarify that a little bit, and I'll see if I can do something with this. Laura says, this may not be a question for me, it may be just for the group, but Laura Hyatt-Smith says, has anyone done a study comparing and contrasting the many secret police groups' tactics, techniques, philosophies that totalitarian societies set up? I ask because there seem to be many commonalities between these countries' secret police groups and their operations. Well, Laura, that's an excellent question. And there are a couple of works that deal with it peripherally. I don't know of any that are full-fledged comparisons. But you're right. I mean, they have this, they all have this, you know, I think if we were inside these groups, I think we would find inside these groups a lot of sort of rah-rah enthusiasm to kind of get each other charged up. You know, there's a little YouTube video I saw the other day. It's a recent Russian movie where maybe some of you know the movie, where it shows an NKVD squad or Cheka squad about to go out to the countryside and steal grain from people. And it's this rousing speech, and they're all on horseback, and a guy is, you know, the leader of the group is getting them all hyped up and everything. And I know that's the way the SS operated, with the kind of esprit de corps, and we are, you know, one thing to go back to the Cheka, one thing that the Solzhenitsyn mentions is that the old Chekisti, the old Chekists, were always proud of that designation and had this kind of esprit de corps. And a couple of the interviews that that Robert Conquest did for his great series on Russian history in the period of in the 20th century, in one of those he interviewed. This would be probably in the early 90s. He interviewed an old Chekist, and this elderly man starts talking about his days riding out against the white terror and going to help the revolution. And at one point he says, well, what did I care? I was a Czechist. So I think there's a lot of that kind of esprit, in addition to all the other things, all the things about repressing people, about keeping them down, about treating them like insects, all these things. I think this work is pretty ugly work, and they have to do that. So the whole scene is phenomenally interesting. Yeah, I don't know of anybody who's done a really good comparison of all those. Cam says, do you know of any good books that deal with Lithuania and Stalin? And, you know, right off the cuff, I do not. I might be able to think of something later, but at the moment, I cannot. I'm sorry. Oh, I see. Okay, so Peter says, up above, he said, why did so many people go to the Soviet Union? And so in the 30s, absolutely, yes. I know, yes. And there's a couple of books about this. Some people went over with Ford. Well, here's what I think, Peter. I think that part of the reason that some American businessmen welcomed the Bolshevik Revolution, and some of them did, was that they thought with this new regime that they'd be able to get into the on the ground floor in a lot of ways. If they thought, for example, of farm implements alone in a country where basically people were still cutting their wheat with sickles, not even scythes, but sickles. They thought, well, if we can just get in there and introduce the tractor, then. And how many peasants are there? 100 million. And so there's this market that's just absolutely stunningly unbelievable. And so International Harvester goes, okay? And in spite of the fact that they know they're involved now and their people can see what's happening on the ground with this collectivization, which would be where you would use the tractor in the end. And maybe they encourage collectivization because that means that some peasants, a collective, can buy a tractor where others couldn't. So I'm sure there's some feelings like that. I mean, I just don't think that they were necessarily very sympathetic to the people there. But I don't know. It's a good question. Why did all those people do it? Some people were quite aware of what Stalin was doing, and of course some people were not quite sure what was going on. And they assumed that, you know, the more that was produced for Russia, the more the cars there were and so forth, the more Russians would come into a, you know, sort of move forward. That's a good question. Lee says, did the Stasi later take many of its members from Soviet secret police or German SS Gestapo? They took the Stasi had a lot of people in it who had worked for the Gestapo eventually, because after all they had the skills, they had the they knew what was going on, so there were secret police types, and this happens in almost every situation where you have a turnover. This is a point in very early on in the first book of Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn tells us that many of these blue caps, as they called them, who were the interrogators of in the first waves of the Czechist terror, that many of these guys had been in the Okhrana. So that's their job. They're secret police. They're interrogators. They're experts in enhanced techniques, etc., so they can do them just as well for the communists as they can for the Tsar. So, there's a lot of that. The Stasi did take a lot of its early membership. You got to also remember that, and this is a special case of the German Democratic Republic, when the communists came to take over in the Soviet zone under the Soviet umbrella in 1945, they had to think a lot about what they would say had happened in terms of the Germans, in terms of the Nazis. And they had to create a story that was basically in line with Stalin's story, which was that the Germans were, that German Nazis were fascists. And just like all the West was fascist, the German Nazis were just like all the rest of them. So they had to kind of, hew to that line. And the line they ended up hewing to was that, well, there's a lot of things bad about the old, about the Third Reich, but spit and polish and goose-stepping and uniforms and secret police and torture cells, these weren't part of it. These are just part of, you know, normal government. So this was an argument that was used a lot by people, and one that they kind of thought of in those terms. Nancy Tomko says, Mises often puts forth the view that unless the majority supports the ideology held by those in power, then eventually the rulers will be overthrown. How was it that the Lenin-Stalin regimes lasted so long? Did the majority of Russians support the communist ideology, or was it primarily fear, poverty, hunger that prevented any groups from acting against those in the Russian government? Well, that's a huge question. I mean, and I'm not sure that I can answer it. I can speak to it for just a few minutes, Matthew. It's certainly true that people can that there has to be some kind of support for an ideology in a certain sense. But on the other hand, if people are enslaved and if they don't have guns, it's just extremely hard to shoot your way out of a dictatorship of any kind. I mean, it's you may say, well, you know, I mean, it's the old Etienne de la Boetie argument. Well, there's just so many of us and so few of them. Why don't we just go, you know, storm the government and get the SOBs and throw them out, you know. But that's more easily said than done. I mean, you know, with the best means in the world, these military people who tried to overthrow Hitler by killing him, they never were able to do it. And they had access to, those few people had access to guns, but of course Hitler's people had access to a lot more. So in modern times, it is pretty hard to do that. Russia's a special case too. Russia is such a huge entity. In fact, it's a huge bundle of entities. And so traditionally, things happen in Russia that don't happen elsewhere. I'm thinking, for example, of the tendency in Russian history for Russian society to just fall apart when Russia is engaged in a war somewhere on its periphery or even abroad, and the fighting doesn't go well. And it's true, it's a drain on society, but then in Russia, society just falls apart and they have a revolution or chaos or something, okay? But in Russia, when an enemy invades, then everybody rallies around, even if it's a horrible leader like Stalin or like the Tsars in power when the Poles invaded and the Lithuanians invaded in the 1600s. But in each of these cases, or, you know, when Napoleon invades, everybody just rallies around, and this somehow in Russian culture and geography and society, this is kind of a clarion call. And so a number of times these things have happened, and the communist leaders have played on these odd patterns and sort of kept people to it. I don't think most Russians liked communism very well. I don't think most Eastern Europeans, I don't think, you know, most people on the whole have been under communism of all the many, many hundreds of millions. have liked it very well. It's just, I mean, the question is, how do you get out of it? How do you, you have a regime like the Syrians, and frankly, I mean, how do we compare the current, the current Syrian or the old military Egyptian regime or some modern regime? And it just takes everything, and it's touch and go, and you don't know if it's going to work, even if you've got all kinds of support from the media and from the West and even, possibly other kinds of support there. So, yeah, it's a big question. It is necessary for these regimes to have some kind of popular support, and they can rally it sometimes. But we're also not sure the extent to which that support is constant or inconstant. So that's probably a kind of a vague answer, but it's a big question. That's a huge question. Maybe you should write a book about that. Okay. Lee Cape says, didn't Walter Duranty and others, many that later served in the Roosevelt administration, come back praising the Soviet system? Oh, yes. There's a whole slew of Westerners who came back praising the Soviet system. Called it the Great Experiment, called it the Hope of Mankind, called it all kinds of things. Yeah, I mean, well, they were electrifying the countryside, and that's just what the, FDR wanted to do. They were modernizing the factories, making big hydroelectric dams, digging canals where no canal probably should have been, but it was at least a canal, and they were digging it. And so these Americans went over and saw this. But of course, I mean, whether they saw the signs of the repression, this is of course a different question. I mean, face it, all the gulag was people were either in cellars in the cities or in Siberia someplace. Same way we're talking about being aware of all the, why didn't all the Germans know about the death camps? Well, because they were in Poland in remote places. So I mean, that's an easy answer. So, in a way, these people just swallowed the propaganda and didn't ask anything else. I remember Arthur Koestler, that's K-O-E-S-T-L-E-R. Arthur Koestler wrote a series of classic memoirs of Europe in this period. And he himself was a communist at one point and later sort of converted to quite a different outlook. But he talked about a band of journalists who took a balloon ride over Russia, and they were going over this big settlement. One of them said, "But this settlement is not on the map." And these other journalists said, "Oh, that is so wonderful that the Soviet system is so great that people are even going out and building completely new towns all on their own." And Koestler said he was a communist agent at that point. He said he just didn't. He didn't think he should tell them that was a concentration camp they were flying over, and that they, that they just didn't know it. So there's an awful lot of obtuseness there. There's some conscious changing. I mean, some of these people were conscious Comintern Soviet agents. I really didn't mention much about the Comintern today, but that's part of all this history. I mean, it's the international arm of the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. And the some of these folks were actually in the Comintern. A lot of Europeans, especially a lot of Britons, some Americans got involved in this, and hence all these high-ranking spies for the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 1940s. Post-World War II kinds of spectacular spy cases, you know who I'm talking about. Lee says, a while ago I came across an article that claimed that Stalin tried to breed humans with gorillas or apes in an attempt to create a superhuman soldier. I don't know anything about that, Lee. It would surprise me a little if that were true, but not a lot. Because uh, if if Stalin was a little backward in where it came to economics, I can tell you he was extremely backward where it came to science. And some of his some of the science that he gave the go-ahead to was pretty wacky. But that one I've never heard anything about. So if you find out, please do let me know. All right? Okay. Well, are we running out of steam here? We have more questions. Let me check the other question. Like, no, nothing there. Let's see. 605. Maybe everybody's got other fish to fry. Possibly actual fish that they intend to fry, since it could be supper time. So, what do you say? More questions, or do you want to call it quits? Ah, Lee came up with another one. How aware of the Holocaust do you think normal Germans were? How did they not know Jews were disappearing? Lee, they knew Jews were people who lived in cities where the Jews mostly lived knew that Jews were disappearing. Some Germans, like my old friend Georg Eisenhardt, they lived in a little market town or outside a little market town in East Prussia, and they knew that there was a Jewish man in the neighboring town, but none of them were acquainted with him. So in their town there were no Jews, and they didn't, you know, they didn't really see anybody depart. Now, they read in the newspaper, this is what Georg told me, he's now deceased, but he fought on the Eastern Front, he was of that age. He said in their little town, what he and his family knew was that Jews were being resettled to the East, and that they had been somehow found out to be enemies of the state. And that really didn't concern his family at all, and they didn't know much about it. And they accepted the idea that these Jews had somehow been enemies of the state. He said they just didn't, you know, insofar as they accepted or didn't accept it, they were just farmers. But he said that that insofar as they read that the Jews were going to be sent to settlements in the East and that they'd have to all work hard, Georg said to me, and so when we heard that they were just going to go somewhere and have to work hard, we didn't think that that was a dishonorable thing because we had to work hard all the time. So in this one little case, this one single case that I know about more than many I know about personally, but Eisenhardt just simply, Georg Eisenhardt just simply said, you know, they knew that something was happening, but there's no reaction to that. I mean, they weren't going to stop their farming and go ask somebody about it. They were just, you know, that's what they heard was happening. I think people in cities knew that Jews were being deported different places. But I'll say this, I don't think that normal Germans, in the sense you're using that word, just the average German knew much. If you know, I may have mentioned this book a week or two ago, a book by Alfons Heck. It's a memoir, and it's called Hitler's Child, and he was a member of the Hitler Youth, a very high-ranking one. And at the end of the war, about 44, his Hitler Youth group was building a tank traps and ditches and obstacles and things on the west wall, in preparation for the Allied attack. And in his unit, a man had been sent to be the official commander of this Hitler Youth unit, and he was a man who had lost an arm on the Eastern Front, an officer. So this young German lieutenant is there with these Hitler Youth leaders, and one night in the tent with Alfons Heck, he got drunk and he started telling Alfons Heck, this enthusiastic Hitler Youth, he started saying, some terrible things have happened in the East. They're killing Jews by the hundreds and by the thousands. They're lining them up in front of trenches and just shooting them. I've seen it. Alfons Heck immediately said, not only are you drunk, Lieutenant, but you've just committed treason. The German people could never, ever do anything like that. Hitler's Hitler's Germany is a different Germany from that, and I'm going to go denounce you right now to our superiors for defeatist talk. Well, he goes to do it and jumps on his motor scooter to go to the headquarters, and then he decides, well, he's lost an arm in the East, and he's drunk, and even though I'm a true believer, I believe in people getting a second chance. So he comes around and says, okay, I'm not gonna report you, but if you ever say anything like that again, you will know that I will denounce you as a traitor. So, you know, what do you do with that? I've got another one for you, if everybody's willing to listen. one of the people who died for opposing Hitler, Count Helmut James von Moltke, M-O-L-T-K-E, was a really outstanding attorney, and it was a family who couldn't stand Hitler before the war. But the war started, and he enlisted just like everybody else, and went into military intelligence, and eventually the international law part of the military, from intelligence to the kind of legal branch. And his job was going to all the occupied places, and his goal was, as he consulted about legal issues of international law with, for example, the commander of the military governor of Belgium or whatever, that his personal goal was to kind of ameliorate things, to kind of stop them from shooting so many people in reprisal and stop them from, you know, so many depredations. And so so he went all over the place. I mean, he went to, he had carte blanche to go everywhere because he was traveling for the military. So he's very highly placed. He had already begun to make contacts with other people who wanted to revolt against Hitler, and he was just on the verge of organizing a series of talks at his home that we now call the Kreisau Circle, one of the resistance groups to Hitler. But he writes to his wife in the spring of 1942. Now, the Holocaust has already been, the final solution's already been going on since the end of the summer, you know, 6 months. And he writes to his wife, I saw your brother today, and he told me something that I cannot believe. And we know from her testimony, I mean, she outlived the war, his wife did, the brother had somehow found out from somebody, these were highly placed, well-connected Germans, he had found out from somebody in the military that Jews were being killed in mass numbers. And so Helmut James von Moltke was willing to believe anything about the Hitler regime, but he just couldn't believe that. Well, he goes on, and it's about another 6 months. So the Holocaust has been going on for a year, and he writes to his wife, Freya. He writes to his wife, I had a terrible blow today. I'll tell you more later, but I found out that what your brother mentioned to me a few months ago is true. So if a highly placed guy, an expert in international law, who's dealing with such issues all the time, I mean, issues related to occupation and war crimes and all this, if this guy can't find out when he's trying to find out for 6 months that the Holocaust is happening, then how could, you know, just your average inhabitant of Hamburg or Stuttgart figure all this out? They weren't being killed there. They were being killed in Poland, and to some extent in the camp system before they got to Poland. But in any case, there's a big discussion of this, and every few years somebody comes out and says, no, all the Germans knew about it. But I'll have to say that all the evidence points to a very limited. Now, a lot of people did know about it. For example, every railroad engineer who hauled trainload full of Jews to Treblinka knew what was going on, every single one. And all of the train people, all the officials high officials who routed those cars out to the, you know, full, and they came back empty. They knew, but you have to, you've got little blocks of people, and to have talked about this would have been to commit a death penalty offense. So that limits it a little bit too, although it gets to be very broad when you start thinking about these kinds of things. Okay, let's see. I hope that's a good answer. And Lee, you're welcome to ask any more questions about that. I've thought about this for a long time. I've talked to a lot of Germans about it. I talked to a lot of people who experienced the war about it. And so at some point, you know, I'll be glad to say more about that. So Cam has discovered the whole, oh my goodness, crossbreed a human and an ape. Well, as I say, I'm surprised, but not very surprised. So, yeah, okay, well, that's a new one on me. It's pretty disturbing, yes. I think gorillas, crossing gorillas and humans is disturbing, yes. In fact, I don't want to know how that all came about or how it was practiced. Okay. Jeff then says, I guess it is the distance between the bureaucrats and their victims that enable these killing machines to operate. Do you think that is the fundamental issue, remoteness from the consequences of their action? Yeah, sometimes. I mean, when you get right down to it, this is an interesting thing. You have different cases. For example, Franz Stangl, whom Gita Sereny interviewed, and I do recommend that book very highly. Franz Stangl, he knew what he was doing. He was the commander of the camp. Oops, sorry. His family lived there at the camp with him, right outside the gates, and he knew that just inside the gates, all this killing was going on all day long. And in fact, he's the one who invented the little system of the fake railway station, even with flowers planted around to make it seem like it was a really calm little nice railway station where they got off and then they'd march off to their death almost immediately. And he's the one who thought all this up. But he said to himself, he was given this job and he was just making it go right. And he was, by faking up this little railway station, he in fact helped people. I mean, he made their last moments a little less stressful, et cetera, et cetera. And he talked to her in that vein. You know, a number of the perpetrators said, well, you know, we didn't really inflict much pain. We basically just put these people to death. I mean, and part of the way those kinds of people who were involved in the killing got through it was that they dehumanized the Jews. Do you know that in the paperwork, and this goes to your question about the, you know, the bureaucrats, in the paperwork, when they scheduled those trains to go to the killing centers, they never said there will be 200 persons per car or whatever. They wrote there will be 200 pieces per car, as if they were just a lumber or something. So they say 500 Stück for Wagen, you know. And so that's a pretty interesting thing, too. There's all kinds of ways. But in the end, in the camps, a lot of the killing was done by others, by Ukrainian, Lithuanian, Latvian volunteers. A lot of the killing was done in the Operation Reinhardt camps by the Jews themselves. I mean, the Sonderkommando in Auschwitz also was Jewish that did the actual killing. So there's a part of that. But now these guys we read about in the, I mean, to me, one of the most important answers is in this this book about the Police Battalion 101, where you get the actual comments of these guys after the war. Some of them saying, well, we just did our duty, and some of them saying, I didn't want to do it, but I had to do it, and some of them saying, I couldn't do it, and I wasn't going to do it. Those are pretty important components to this answer too. So Leslie says, libertarian historian James J. Martin has written that the Katyn Forest Massacre was the only mass murder in this period that we have hard forensic evidence for. And Leslie, I like James J. Martin very, very well, but I don't agree with him on that. How do historians establish the accuracy of mass murder, famine, etc. statistics between a figure of 100,000 estimated death versus 10 million? Well, there's a number of ways to do it, and there are a lot of forensic sites. I mean, we do have a lot of mass murder sites that have been dug up and where the bones have somehow survived and not dissolved and all that. So I do disagree with Martin. I like him on so many points, and some of his writing is just tremendous, but I don't agree with him on that. But if you don't have forensic evidence, then you have to start looking at the records. For example, I've done a whole lot of work with these mass expulsions of Germans right at the end of the war from Poland, Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, to some extent Romania, and we know something from the local records of the places. We know something from the camps where these people who were driven out landed. We know something from statistics, and a lot of these people later kind of put this all back together and had refugee location centers and tried to kind of match person for person to see who had gotten out and who had been killed and who was still in Poland or whatever. And so there's a lot of work that went into this over the 10 years after the war, and that finally kind of settled out for these people that about 15 million had been driven out. We always said about 1.5 million, 1.7 million died. That's now being estimated down just a little bit. But yeah, these numbers are hard to come to. But in the cases of the German killings of Jews, they did keep really close records of that. I mean, and we know I think the total has come down from they used to say 7 million or 8 million or something like that. And I think that the total is just because they've worked more with the numbers. And, of course, there are political reasons why you'd want to have a higher number, because Germany would then have to pay more payments to Israel and so forth and so on. There's this whole area there that's where it's politicized. But on the other hand, the historians have really come up with a number around between 4 and 5 million, and I think that's all very sound. And Polish scholars working with records at the Auschwitz State Historical Museum and other scholars elsewhere, I think they've done a pretty good way. But they have to triangulate. I mean, you're right. If you don't have the evidence of the bodies, you're right. You do have to really triangulate and try to figure out from census data and from all kinds of ways how many died. How many also are in the area? How many are living after the fact when that thing is over? This is one of the things about the bombing of Dresden. That's the numbers are always in dispute because we're not sure how many refugees were there, and we don't know where to put those killed refugees versus other killed refugees. So this is all pretty tough. I mean, it's a really good question. How do you make that all work out? Well, Lee says he has to go. If you're already gone, then I'll see you next time. And if you're not gone, I'll see you next time. Thank you very much, and I guess we'll call it a night. But keep these. If you have any more questions over the week, just save them up, and we'll talk about them next week. And I won't go so long, and we'll have a longer question and answer then. All right? So let's call it a night, and Easter to you, too. Thank you, everybody. Thanks for attending. See you later.